Hi, welcome to the UCB Theater Podcast for the week of May 30th, 2010. I'm John Frusciante.
And I'm Eric Tenoy, filling in for Will Hines.
Yeah, Eric Tenoy is our guest host today, and we have, in just a minute, our guest this week, Anthony King. Very excited about that.
He's the artistic director of the UCB Theater.
Oh, is that who he is?
I believe so.
I just saw him in the hall, and I thought, I've seen him around. He looks like he might know things.
No, I think he's the artistic director of the theater.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see what that means. Not sure. All right, first we're going to talk about shows this week. Thursday, June 3rd, we have Two Square coming back.
Great show.
Yeah.
That is a version of the longer show, Four Square,
right,
which involved four improvisers. Two Square is two of them, which I believe this week is John Lutz.
And Peter Gross.
Great. So John Lutz, last year writer for Saturday Night Live, and appeared in 30 Rock as the character Lutz.
Yeah, everybody loves the show. Everybody flocks out to see it. So don't be a jerk and stay home.
And Peter Gross, writer for the Colbert Report.
Right, of course.
And then on Friday, Thunder Gulch Pop Culture Apocalypse.
Yeah, new sketch show. I'm plugging it because I directed it, and I want people to come see it. So this is me taking advantage of my position here as podcast host.
And I think I saw an earlier version of this show, right?
Yeah, it's all sketches about pop culture, and they have to do with pop culture.
Famous sketches like, is Chili Dog Mountain?
Chili Dog Mountain. The legendary Chili Dog Mountain is the show closer.
It's a great sketch.
Thunder Gulch is a mod team, and we got to do this run. We're excited about it, and we would like you to come out.
Great.
And then midnight, on the same night, Friday, June 4th, is Funny Folk. This is Thin Skin Johnny and Ben Lerman. Thin Skin Johnny, they're a folk band. They do, like, funny folk songs. And Ben Lerman is a ukulele player, also does funny ukulele songs. The two of them together are doing this show, so come out and see this musical comedy show.
So that is great if you're a fan of music or comedy, or ideally, if you're a fan of both.
Right, or if you're like, I'm a fan of both of those things, but would they work well together?
Yes, or if you like alliteration.
Right.
And then Saturday at midnight is the Dirtiest Sketch in New York City contest. That is a sketch show,
yeah,
filled with dirty sketches.
Yeah, so if you're a sketch writer and you're listening to this, you should submit to the Dirtiest Sketch Show. Go on the UCB website, check the calendar, and find out where you can submit. We do this, you know, a few times a year. People submit their dirtiest, filthiest sketches, 3 to 5 minutes in length. Then they get to perform them, and they're judged by the audience. It's hosted by me, the hilarious Gil Ozeri, and the also hilarious John Flynn.
Also all notoriously vile people.
Yeah, we're all terrible, disgusting, dirty people.
Can we discuss in the past what kinds of things have happened at this show?
The last sketch that won was a actual 10-year-old boy talking to his dad about how he was having an active sexual affair with his mother.
Great.
It was hilarious. We've also had people fucking chickens to pieces on stage. We've had people
put peanut butter in their ass, I believe.
Putting peanut butter in their ass. People engaging in actual sex acts on stage. So it's great to submit to, and it's also great to come out and watch. Even if you don't have a horse in the race, come out and get drunk with us and enjoy this ridiculous
theater
nonsense.
In the, I don't know how to pronounce this word, Grand Guignol tradition? Am I at all close?
I think so. Okay, so those are the shows you're going to be seeing, you should be going to see this week. And we're going to move right along to the interview segment instead of breaking it up. Are you ready for that today?
Yes.
Are you prepared?
I was pretending to hear music in my head. Do, 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 do. No music.
Great.
All right.
Okay, so in the booth with us is Anthony King.
Hello.
Hi, Anthony.
I've been pretending not to be here for the last few months.
We asked you to pretend for the purposes of theater and dramatics.
Yeah, I was worried about describing these shows in front of you, and what if he didn't like the way we described them?
Yeah.
I could bite my tongue. Yeah. Oh, I don't exist. I can't correct them.
So you are the artistic director for the UCB Theater.
Yes, I am.
And you've been
in New York.
In New York, the New York Theater. And you've been the artistic director for the past, what is it, 5 years now?
Yeah, almost 5.5 years, yeah.
That's great. And full disclosure, you are my boss. But this is not going to be some cock-sucking puff piece about Anthony, okay?
Yes.
So if you're expecting that, there's going to be a lot of hard questions asked here.
He's not really my boss, so I can ask the hard questions.
Right. That's why Eric's here.
That's right. Okay, so how did you get to the UCB?
The short answer is Charlie Todd, but the, and I guess Tara Copeland to a smaller degree, but...
Sorry, can I interrupt right away?
Yeah, yeah, please.
You're, in addition to being the artistic director, we should describe you. You're also a performer. You perform with
Ruben
Williams, the improv group on Saturday nights. You play at Let's Have a Ball.
Yes, I do Gravid Water pretty regularly. Mm-hmm. And I write shows and that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, you.
I don't co-wrote, just crush dreams.
Yes, you co-wrote the musical Gutenberg.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, which was originally a Spank here at the theater, and then ran here at the theater for a while, and then moved to Off Broadway.
Yes. And now is all over the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we'll get into more about that kind of stuff.
I did improv in college, and also directed theater, and then I moved to New York to direct theater. And when I moved to New York, I remember thinking, I'll never do improv again. I'd only done short form. And then I directed theater for a while, and then Charlie Todd moved. And if you listen to the Charlie Todd podcast, you can get a much more detailed version of the story. But
yeah, he talked a lot about the two of you coming up here.
Yeah, and so through Charlie, basically, I started doing long form and then kind of found my way into the theater.
Did you think that in New York there was just no outlet for improv?
I just thought, I knew of UCB vaguely because I went on a couple dates with a friend of Tara Copeland's who was working in the theater. It was very bizarre. So I met Tara before I even knew what UCB was. But I was just so focused on theater that I didn't think I was going to do comedy. And then through a series of frustrations and happy coincidences, I ended up doing things at UCB. And then when Owen Burke left, I had directed a lot of shows at the theater, and I had written a few shows, including Gutenberg. And then off of that, I think Owen decided to ask me to take over when he left.
Mm-hmm. So you showed up, you started taking classes, and then you your first Harold team that you were on was Dillinger.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And then from Dillinger, you is it true that you left Dillinger to focus on Ruben Williams? That you were in a practice group, Robin Williams?
Yeah, we had started Robin Williams just to screw around, and then we got approached by Besser to say, do we want to be a team? And originally it was going to be on Friday night, like we'll put you on Friday night. So it was like, how do you say no to that?
Right.
And we liked playing together, so we said yes, and then after we said yes, it was, it seems a little hasty to just automatically put you on Friday night. You've never all played together at the theater, which we also agreed with.
Right.
So we became a Harold team instead. And I was happier with that, too, since I was simultaneously becoming artistic director, although no one knew that at the time.
But it would have been weird to simultaneously make, I am the new artistic director. I have given myself a Friday night.
Right. Not only that, but I am now on Friday night.
So you had been approached already to, you were kind of being groomed over the theater.
Yeah, we had like nailed it down about 3 or 4 months before Owen actually left. Because Owen wasn't sure who he would ask if I said no, so he wanted to ask early.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of had to sit on it for a long time.
So you knew, but you couldn't really tell anybody.
Yeah, I couldn't tell anybody.
and
the funniest thing is it was announced during a time of a lot of Harold team upheaval. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were being cut and teams were being changed, which I had nothing to do with.
Right.
And so when it was announced, it was on a list of things that were basically like... this is the new Harold lineup. Sorry for everyone who got cut. I think the third thing on the list was, if you see a light on, turn it off, save power. And then number four was, the new artistic director's Anthony Gannon. So I kind of slumped in.
Right.
Well, it's also much more important to make sure that we're saving electricity than that we have artistic stewardship.
Yeah,
the
we want to have a theater around to run.
Best lights in New York, I think is what we're
That's right. Theater. Yeah, Time Out New York has given us that a few times.
Yeah.
So then Robin Williams became Ruben Williams, became a Saturday night team.
Yes.
Where they still are to this day.
True.
And so you mentioned that you were also writing shows and directing shows. I know you wrote a show called Day 8, right?
I did. That's the first thing I did at UCB. It was a solo show it was just like a character solo show.
Mm-hmm.
That was tied together with Anthony Robbins. So dated. Anthony Robbins, I edited a bunch of Anthony Robbins tapes to make him sound like a lunatic, and then played those between the sketches because all the characters were a little... Like one of the characters was a guy that had his best friend was a giant blown up picture of Brian Gumbel.
Also dated.
Also dated. Yeah. But at the time, so current. And so he, and the whole thing was he had gone to try to meet Brian Gumbel, and it had totally backfired, and he was complaining to his giant picture of Brian Gumbel about that.
When you put that show up, was it your intention that you just wanted to perform more, or you wanted to try creating a show?
I had been, I've written plays before, and I had been working in the theater, and then I was going to do a show with someone else, and it kind of fell apart, and I had all this, all these monologues I had written, so I wanted to do something, so I just put them together and made a show. Charlie Todd directed it, so it was kind of just I wanted to get up on the stage, and I was pretty new to the theater, and the spank that we did was me and Neil Casey and Joe Wengert were doing sketch for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being a spank that had people that were going to be around for a long time, but no one knew it.
Right.
I feel like, though, there was a sense, and that was also at the Chelsea Playhouse, right?
We were between theaters.
I remember feeling like, because both those shows were great, Your Favorite Thing and the Day 8, and it was like, oh, there is like new lifeblood coming. Like, we didn't know that they would be in charge in a few years, but it was like, definitely like a sense that like, oh, the theater hasn't fallen apart because there's no physical space at this time. It's like, no, people are still putting up awesome shows here.
Yeah, there's still a spirit of people wanting to continue making this happen. There's just no body for it to.
But there was like an electric energy that night at that show.
It was definitely a fun night.
Mm-hmm.
So can I ask a more general question?
Yeah, please.
So can you kind of run us through your responsibilities in terms of like, what do you do?
As artistic director?
Yes.
It's basically my job to decide who and what goes on stage at the theater, because we don't really do a ton of advertising. Most of our advertising is just press that people write about the people who've gotten successful.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the brand we have is what's on our stage. So it's my job in New York to make sure that there's a consistency and a high level of quality to what's on the stage. So I decide what shows get to run and who are on all our Herald teams and our Mod teams. And then we created beta teams, and I put those together as well, which are for UCB Comedy, which I also have, with Todd Bieber, have artistic responsibilities with as well.
Mm-hmm. Those are kind of your general responsibilities.
Yeah, it's basically anything creative at the theater that's involved in the theater. Mm-hmm. I have to be. I'm a part of.
Right.
Who's on Tourco? What Tourco does? Like, mm-hmm, all those things are all part of my job description.
And it's also a lot of just getting the brand of UCB out there.
Yeah, it's just that's the kind of creative side, and then I also do a lot of talking to the press and talking to industry about people in the theater, because that's another thing. Since no one's really paid, I'm very big on what are we giving to the people, what are we providing. And, you know, some of it is you get an amazing space with an amazing audience for free, with free tech, free house management. You don't have to worry about a lot of stuff that you would have to worry about. And then the other side is helping people connect with industry and with press and that kind of stuff, so that people can. The whole mission statement of the theater, which existed long before me, is to help people launch out of the theater so that when they are successful, they'll want to come back and play. Mm-hmm. And we try to keep that loop going. Now the loop includes LA, which is where a lot of the successful people play. But
yeah,
so it's changed a little bit. But mm-hmm, but that is kind of, that's still the mission statement.
So can I ask a question from like an outsider's perspective? If I'm trying to get I'd like to put a show up there.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm, I feel like when I first arrived here, there was a sense, I don't know if this was ever true, but it was like, if you want to put a show up there, you have to get on a Herald team and then hang out at McManus with, I guess, Kevin Mullaney at the time,
right,
or Owen. And then if he's friends with you, he'll put up a show. I'm not saying that ever was true, but I feel like there was that sense.
Almost knocked down our whole room. when I became artistic director, there were two things that I thought needed to really happen, and this was not a statement about anyone who had come before, but just where I thought the theater was. And the biggest one that I told the UCB was that I felt like it needed to go from a clubhouse to a business, meaning that it did feel isolated, that either you were part of the UCB crowd or you couldn't perform at the theater. So it was, part of that was to first make Herald Night a better show than it was, because it was a show that only students came to and did not make any money, which is why at the time it was being moved from Thursday to Tuesday. And so that was one problem. And then also make Herald Night only one night of the theater, because it did used to be, if you weren't on a Herald team, you kind of weren't involved at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to change that
because I don't think that's healthy. And I think just because there's a lot of very, very funny people who aren't necessarily the best improvisers, but they're amazing writers or performers or whatever, and we should be a theater for them too.
Yeah, we should have just as much space for people like that to come in and perform as well, and not just make it like, you know, you gotta be BFF with everybody.
Yeah,
you know?
It just starts, everyone thinks it's political. And
yeah.
So here's, I'll ask some other questions. I'm an outsider. I'm trying to get my show up in theater.
Yeah, okay, great.
So one thing that I imagine happens, because I used to work at a film festival and this would happen, is like, I imagine you get a lot of people pitching shows who have never seen a show at the theater, have no sensibility of like, what does the theater want? So that's probably like the first step if you want to put a show up is like, well, go see the shows at the theater and see if it fits in there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that makes the most sense. If you haven't ever seen a show at the theater, then I don't know why you want to do your show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So I have a show. Let's say I have it written, but I haven't ever performed it. Mm-hmm. What, can I call you? What do I do?
Well, you can just submit your script. If you go on the website, there's a FAQ that will tell you how to submit for Spank. And Spank is how we audition shows for the theater. There's primarily scripted shows, solo shows, sketch shows, storytelling shows, whatever. But that's where you can submit. And any living person who has a show that's 35 minutes or less can submit that. Show. We used to put everything up that was submitted, but there's just too many shows now, so we can't do that. So we do weed it down. If we see potential in your script, then we put it up on the stage. And then if we think it has potential on the stage, we'll work with you to develop it for a run at the theater. But we really, I mean, the theater is a place where it's like we help you, but you are really kind of self-producing. Mm-hmm. We don't cast your show for you or put it up. You can't just give us a script and have us do your show. That's just not the way the theater's set up.
But you'll get all my audience in for me, right?
Yeah. Your audience we'll take care of. No, but I think that it's one big difference between us and most theaters. Is most theaters, they like a script and they produce it.
Right.
And we are a place that provides artistic kind of oversight for self-produced shows for the most part, except for our house shows. That's kind of the way the theater works.
Did your outsider have another question?
Yeah, so I put up a show. You gave me a spec slot. I do my show. Then what happens?
Uh-huh.
If the show is like great and we feel like it's ready to run, and I can get into what that means if it's useful, but then we talk about doing a run, which typically is twice a month, just because it works well for audiences and that kind of stuff in our format. If we feel like it's not quite ready but has potential, then we'll go into development process where I give notes and we kind of try to start developing it to improve the show. And then if I feel like it's not right, then I say thanks for doing it, but no thanks. And when I talk about what's being right, I think this is a question a lot of people have. It's not what I personally like. I mean, obviously, all of this is subjective. And that's why, I mean, I am in this job because that's my job is to be the voice of that subjectivity.
Right.
But I really don't just, there are a lot of shows that have run at the theater that are not necessarily my cup of tea, but I mostly watch a show to think, the first thing I'm thinking is, what are they trying to do? If I can't understand what they're trying to do, then there's a problem, right? Then I think, is what they're trying to do worthy of the stage? So like, if what you're trying to do is I'm going to piss in a jug for 30 minutes, I might get that's what you're trying to do, but I personally don't think that's worthy of the stage.
Right.
Probably. You may execute it in a way that makes it worthy, but
you're not even pissing into the jug. You're not even. Right.
If you're missing the jug completely.
But you know what I mean? Like there's some things that are just like, oh, I see what you're doing, but it kind of just doesn't work for what we do. And then the other thing is just, do they execute what they're trying to do in a way that feels successful? Like, mm-hmm. were they successful? So like if you set up, you know, we're doing, it's a late night cable channel and here are all the shows. Well, did you execute that? Does it feel like the promise you made to the audience has been fulfilled?
Right.
And so that's kind of how I look at it, to try to put objectivity in what is a completely subjective thing. I try to use those kind of questions. So if you're writing a show and doing a show for Spank, you can ask yourself those questions too, because it definitely blows my mind the number of shows I watch that I sat in silence with the rest of the silent audience, and then afterwards the people are like, do we get a run? And I'm like, what room are you in? We were all in the same room where no one was laughing for 30 minutes. So
would you say that the UCB is primarily a comedy theater?
It is primarily. Primarily
well, that
a comedy
that
theater.
Raises the question that I had is
unless you're watching The Stepfathers.
Ooh. Oh boy, that'll be the first of many zings.
That's not comedy.
Then it's an art theater.
So that does raise the issue of, you know, you talked about what are they trying to do and does it work on stage? There's also, I imagine, shows that work, but they're not necessarily for what the UCB Theater does or
sure,
is.
Sure. There are shows I've seen that I've actually liked a lot that I think, like, we're a comedy theater, so people are, and our audience is coming to see comedy. So if your show is, I've seen very funny shows about very dark subjects, but if your show kind of just really stays in that dark, dramatic place for a long time and doesn't earn the comedy, well, it's not going to be even fair to you when I'm pairing it with a bunch of white 20-year-olds who are running around slapping each other's bare asses.
That's the Stepfathers.
Told you. It's art. That's not good for anybody. So I often, one note I've given a lot of shows is I think this is more of a Fringe Festival show than a show for us, just because we are a comedy theater. But that's not to say you can't do something that has some pathos to it. You definitely can, and I personally love that stuff.
Right.
And there's been a lot of really successful shows like that.
Mm-hmm. So then my follow-up question is, I submit a show, I do a spank, you give me some notes, you don't give me a run, I should assume that you dislike me personally, right?
Yeah.
Anthony King
it's
doesn't like
me. It's how I settle
me.
Personal vendettas, which I have so many of. Every decision I make, I calculate, who am I destroying?
You calculate it for most destructive.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
I think, you know, Any time I say no to a show, I'm like, that doesn't mean you can't. I don't want to see that show again if I say no. But if you write something new, I'm usually happy to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume you're happy. Like, so you get a show and it's great, and you put it up and it does well. Like, that's the best. That's the best thing. But
yeah, I think that's the big thing to remember. Is like, we want the shows to be good. Like, John and I sit through so many spanks every year. And we want them to be good. We are sitting there in the audience. Like, we're not going, this is terrible. We really want it to be good. So we're rooting for the show. And I spend many times in shows that aren't working thinking, is there anything salvageable here? Like, what can we pull from this?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there is something and sometimes there's not.
And is there ever a case where it's like, you know, you could make these changes to put it up here, but I feel like the show sort of works the way it is, just not for us.
Yeah, I've definitely. Where it's like I've given that note thing. Before.
And then if that show takes off, you're also happy, right? Even if it's
oh,
not here,
yeah,
it's
completely.
Like, oh, they had
completely
a great
happy.
Show.
Happy. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if your stranger has any more questions.
yeah, he's got a lot of questions.
Never been to the theater.
I don't know. I saw a video online once, so half of it. So I think we talked a little bit about all the opportunities, I think, and I think that is definitely a big change over time in terms of, like, you don't have to be on a Herald team to be in shows at the theater.
Right. The amount of ways that you can get onto or involved in our stage has definitely increased.
And the big thing, I think, that the guiding principle, if you want to be involved at UCB, is no one's going to hand it to you. And that's the guiding principle of this whole business. So if you think the business is people handing you things, then you're not in the right place.
Yeah.
But if you go and make stuff, people that have been around, improvisers will say, how can I do more shows? Put a show together. That's how. Do the work. And if you do that, then we want to help it. If it's good, we will do a lot of work on your behalf. But we can't just make things for you. So that's everyone I know who's been successful out of this theater, the people who keep creating new things and are working all the time creating new things, not just hanging out with their friends and thinking about the hilarious improv scene they just did.
And some of those things are not going to work, right? But they're...
Oh, yeah. Some of them are not all going to be successful, but you're going to learn from them and you're going to make the next thing better.
Yeah, you got to get over that lizard brain thing of being afraid, you know,
of
being afraid of putting something up and failing. Because that's just what you do. That's what happens. You put shit up and it fails, and then
and
you
also,
put more
like,
stuff up.
A big thing that I think, and I obviously we all struggle with this, is like, but if it fails, everyone will think I'm not funny, and then I'll be dead or something. and I know I struggle.
Like, you'll just stop. Your life will just stop.
I mean, I know I've struggled with that before, and I'm sure everyone kind of thinks that, but that's not true at all. I mean, I know, like, Paul Scheer and Rob Hubel are two of the funniest people I've ever seen. I've seen lots of shows when they were in New York that didn't really work. But at no time did it enter my brain of, maybe I was wrong. Maybe they're not funny.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're funny. That didn't work. And so if you know you're funny and you want to create things, you just have to do it to figure out what works for you.
Mm-hmm. What's your strategy? What was your strategy for figuring out what worked for you? Like, what was your strategy for creating things?
I just did it. I mean, I just wrote what I thought was funny.
Mm-hmm.
The two kind of big shows I did at UCB, that's just what I did. I just wrote what I thought was funny. And then with, like, Gutenberg, part of the reason Owen wanted me to be artistic director is because he would see, we would go off stage after every single performance of Gutenberg, every single line that didn't get a laugh, we would be rewriting it, or at least figuring out how we could play it differently to try to get a laugh out of it. Which is, I think, why the script got better for later versions of the show when we weren't in it anymore. It's because when we were performing it, like, the last thing I wanted to do was go back out there and have to say a line that I knew wasn't going to get a laugh. That's like death. So it always amazes me the number of shows I see that I'm watching it, it's not getting a laugh, and the writers aren't rewriting it. I don't understand how you could sit there every week and watch your show not get the response you're aiming for and just think, well, I know it's funny. It's like, it's clearly not. Something's wrong with it. And so you just have to keep that.
You got to keep working at all times.
You have to keep that working.
And Gutenberg was the musical that you wrote with Scott Brown.
Yes.
And it started here at the theater.
It started as a spank, and we got a run from that with no notes from Owen, but we actually cut a song, rewrote it, and all that stuff right after the spank. There's a song that was only performed one night.
Wow, rarity.
If you saw, Dave Martin's wife said it was her favorite song. So we cut it because of that. Because of that, yeah. We ran it for a long time, for almost a year and a half off and on at the theater.
Mm-hmm. And I believe the cast album is available online and in stores.
And also on the
iTunes
UCB
or Amazon
website.
Or from the UCB website.
That's right, or the UCB Theater, I think you can buy it at as well.
Yeah, if you want a physical copy.
So you were doing this show, and then you were trying to get a run outside the theater with it, or people were coming to
it? People kept mentioning to us that maybe it could have a larger life, so we were trying to get theater producers, and then this British theater producer saw the show and was looking for a cheap show to bring over to London. And since it's a two-man show with very little set, it fit the bill.
I'm going to assume that his name was Nigel and he wears a top hat.
Close. His name was Trevor.
and he wears a bowler.
He wears a bowler, yeah, exactly. So we went to London, Scott and I, and ran the show for 6 weeks in London. Where it got, the first time it really got reviewed, and it got just rave reviews there. Then we rewrote it some more, brought it back, and got Broadway actors to be in it. The amazing Christopher Fitzgerald and Jeremy Sheamus.
Mm-hmm.
Got Alex Timbers involved as a director, who's
the Frères Corbusier.
Yes, who's now bringing Pee Wee's Playhouse to Broadway next
season. Right. And he's also
Bloody Andrew Jackson.
And Bloody Andrew Jackson, he wrote and directed that.
Yep.
And they were all amazing. And then from there, once Scott and I were out of it, we could realize the things that were only funny because we were doing them. And things that weren't ever really that funny, but we just hadn't come up with a better thing for mm-hmm. them. And we wrote it some more for the Off-Broadway cast. And then it opened in New York, two really great reviews. And now it's... you can license it through Samuel French if you want to do it
and
yourself.
A lot of places perform it, right? It just got its first high school production?
High school production just went up. It's in this summer. It's in San Francisco, South Carolina, and somewhere else, Cleveland, I think, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Australian tour is picking back up again in the fall.
Was that a big realization for you to get out of the show, watch other people do it?
It was huge. It's one of the weirdest things ever.
These moments were only funny when we were doing them?
The most bizarre experience was when the first ever regional production was in Salt Lake City. It was all these Reformed Mormons doing the show. And that was the first production we ever saw that we had literally nothing to do with. We just showed up on opening night and watched it because we figured, why not? And I almost lost my mind during it because it hit me how bizarre the show was and how weird it was. And it was a very bizarre night.
What can I ask you? The decision to replace you guys with actors, was that a choice you made or?
We made it with the producer.
Nigel?
With Nigel, yes. He took off his top hat. And he said, no, Scott and I weren't really interested in performing the show all the time. We wanted to do other things.
Yeah.
So, because if you're an actor, you have to be there eight shows a week.
Right.
And so we weren't really interested in that. And we also were worried. We didn't want it to be viewed by the theater as an act, which if it's the writers are doing the show, it feels like an act that we do.
Yeah.
And so to put actual actors in it, that weren't the writers, it becomes an actual play more, or at least it's not an argument anymore if it is a play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So you also, like we mentioned before, you still improvise a lot at the theater.
Tell us about that.
I did have
improv
some.
Improv starts with yes and.
Yeah. Oh, really? Is that how it starts? Oh, my, I'm doing it wrong. I've been watching The Stepfathers.
Pull your pants down, slap your ass.
So the big things that we teach here, that we practice and teach here, the concept of yes and finding and playing game.
Yes.
And I want to get your thoughts on how you approach those things, how you approach yes anding and playing
game.
Well,
game is also what we look for in sketch as well.
Right,
at the theater.
Of course.
So when we are like evaluating Spanx, like whether or not game is happening is a big part of it.
Oh yeah, that's a good thing to mention too.
Big, broad, cartoony sketches. In general, you can have that approach, but there should also be game. And if there's not, then it's probably not going to run. That's another one that gets like not right for us.
So mm-hmm. if a game is like, I'm trying to piss in this jar,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Do I do it?
That's what game is.
Yeah. How are you reacting to the jar? That's the thing.
Why? If it's true that I'm pissing into a jar, what else is true?
Right. What does
I'm
the jar look like?
Into a coffee mug.
I'm also shitting into a coffee mug.
So we're talking about the game of the scene in improv.
Yes. How do I approach it? What do you mean?
Yeah, just you personally. I don't mean like as I'm always interested in stuff like that. This when we have people in here. Not you as evaluating a scene.
Right.
But when you are performing improv, I'm always curious as to what people's process is for stuff like that.
Do you even
think about it anymore? Or
I do. I don't think that I, when I'm on stage, I don't know that I think, what is the game?
I mean, I guess like, what is
I'm
your...
noticing what I think is interesting and then thinking, how can we do that more?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm a big believer that game is just an inherent comedic sensibility. Like if you notice what's funny about a moment, if you want to be funny, you would think, how can we do that more? Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think like, I know the first scene I ever did in long form was in a rehearsal with Jackie Clark with this group of The Office. And I played game. I didn't know what game was, but we had game in the scene just because it was like, that's what was fun about the scene. So to me, it's like just focusing on that, of like, that thing that they just said, that's fun. How can we do that more? That's kind of what hits me when I'm in a scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think definitely people who come here with a comedy background, even if they haven't performed just from watching it, you inherently sort of pick that up.
Well, I think some of it is I did short form for so long. Short form does not teach you how to recognize game necessarily, but it teaches you how to play it, because when someone says in this scene, you will go, when I say forward, you'll go forward. When I say reverse, you'll go reverse.
Yeah.
Well, when you play that 100 times, you start to go, what else can we do with this? Like, if that's the game, what else can we do? How many different ways can we get laughs out of this? And that's just playing, if this is true, what else is true? So it does teach you how to play game, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask another question as a fictional outside
podcast? Oh, yeah, your stranger's back.
Oh, the stranger's back.
Yeah. He's
not a stranger now.
It's gone for a long time.
So now I'm not a stranger. I'm a person who's been improvising for, you know, let's say 3 or 4 years.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I feel like I know what I'm doing. How do you sort of like keep
at the at UCB, you mean?
Let's say I'm on an indie team.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But you're taking classes at
UCB.
Yes,
I'm taking classes at the theater.
Did the stranger spank go well?
I have not done a spank.
Well, you'll get it.
Gotta do a spank.
I've been doing it for a while, and like, how do you keep it fresh for yourself, I guess? You know, like, I get to a point sometimes where I'm like, you know, I'm bored by this, or...
Right.
Yeah, I think everyone goes through troughs and valleys. I know I feel like right now I'm in a rut for myself, like in a trough personally. I think you
I mean,
just
not like Stepfather's bad, but
no.
Well, come on,
my
I mean,
ass
that's...
has not been bare on stage, but but I think you go up and down in that. I think the way out of it for me is just to think what am I not doing? Like right now, I feel like I'm playing the same similar characters a lot, so I've been trying to push myself out of that to just force myself into different kinds of characters. And I think as long as you keep challenging yourself like that, then it'll stay fresh to me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What are your favorite, like right now, kinds of scenes? Are there favorite kinds of scenes where you're like, oh, that one was fun,
Favorite kinds of scenes?
Or things that stand out to you, not necessarily a kind of scene, but like stuff that happens where you're like, oh, I had fun that night because of
blank. You know what's funny is Ruben's been doing the mono scene a lot.
Yeah.
The monologue. One of us does a monologue.
Just one of us.
Everyone else sits in the back line for 30 minutes.
Wow, fascinating.
And I've realized that I don't think it's my favorite form because I really enjoy the connections and callbacks that you get when you cast your net wide and then kind of pull it back together in the last few minutes of the mm-hmm. scene, which happens obviously some in the mono scene, but it's such a controlled thing and there's so much narrative in it that it feels less. I'm not a big fan of plot in general in anything.
Right.
So just because they're what is it, 7 plots, is that what it is?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like, yeah, who cares? But so it's what you do with it. So that's one reason I like improv is because it's not about plot. And so I think that the mono scene is not my favorite thing because of that.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite?
I just love those things where you realize suddenly, oh my God, this and this thing are connected.
Like the third beats of a Harold, for instance.
Those third beats, those connections where, and I'm a really big, I think the best moments in improv don't come from your brain. You suddenly just like feel it in your body. You're suddenly just aware of like, oh God, these two things just came together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most like exhilarating moment, I think.
Yeah, these visceral kinds of like spiritual kind of things that like materialize out of the ether.
You were a part of creating two things that you had no idea were connected, and you just figured out suddenly, oh God, I understand how they're connected now.
Yeah, I think like when you're a beginning improv student, you think, oh, I'll figure out what connections to make in the third beats, and it'll come together awesome. But then when you're actually doing it, you realize the best ones are the ones that you discover in the third beats that you weren't planning to do because they're more natural, less forced. As somebody who watches and performs in a lot of shows, I'd be interested, like, let's say within the last 5 months, 6 months, have you seen anything that like kind of either blew you away or was just like, oh, I hadn't expected to see that, either improv or sketch?
I get mostly like... with improv, I get really excited when I'm watching kind of two people or a group really supporting each other. and I mean not just like everyone's coming off the back line into the scene,
right,
but actually on the same page and making things right for each other. Like mm-hmm. my favorite thing in improv to do and to see is when someone throws up one of those big alley-oops that... and then it actually connects with the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I don't see as many alley-oops in general as I would like to see, because I think that's just a part of it that in this age of everyone's on 8 teams and doing a billion things,
mm-hmm.
you just don't see it as much because it's a little more every man for himself. But I sound like an old grandpa.
Yeah, do you think do you think that's a detrimental thing to be on a lot of teams? Or are you of the school of like go and do it as much as you possibly can?
Personally, I think it's all what you want to do.
Right.
It's all about your goals. Like you want to be, if you want to be really great and experience everything that improv can be, then I think you got to pick a team and work really hard on that team. That doesn't mean you can't do other things, but I think if you're spreading yourself too thin, then you're just becoming, you're like a wandering nomad. And then it is about your survival, not about, you know, connecting with people. It's about you have to survive.
It's about the development of you're more focused on the development of your skill and trying to do it as much as possible rather than
You can't work on the skills of connection because it's only your personal skills.
Uh-huh.
You don't have like the group mind in any group that
you're in. Right.
Yeah, you're not developing like a, right. What's the word I'm looking for? Like you don't belong to a specific group and you're not developing this devotion.
But I also think a huge number, and this is not a judgment, a huge number of people who do improv in this community are just doing it because it's fun.
Right.
And if that's your goal, then who cares how many teams you're on? Have fun, get drunk, do whatever. Like if that's your goal, then I think then you should do whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends on what you're trying to do. I don't look down on anyone if that's your
right.
What you want to do.
There's a difference between the goal of having fun and a goal of actually of developing your comedic chops for something larger.
Yeah, I just think if your goal is to have fun and that's all you're doing, then you can't get upset when you don't get on a Harold team because you're not doing the work.
Right.
You're just having fun,
mm-hmm.
and so you know you just have to be realistic about what you're doing.
It's like if you're on a softball team, Are you trying to get into a minor league baseball team, or are you just like, I enjoy softball?
Is softball a good path to a minor league baseball team?
Well, I feel like if you're trying to get on a minor league baseball team, you should be playing.
I was genuinely not aware of that.
I think a year ago, I got in this weird controversy on an Austin message board. Someone had taken something I'd said in an interview and put it on this message board, and then everyone was trashing me. And then someone from Minnesota wrote me and said, you need to go on this message board. So it was like a weird thing. But I basically said that all bad improv, all good improv kind of looks the same no matter where you've learned it or what you where you're from, but bad improv can all be wildly different. And they took that as a big insult that I was somehow saying that all good improv is only one certain thing.
Like the one certain thing that you
that I like,
right?
Or whatever. What I meant by that and what I said on there is that not a great analogy, but I feel like at this point with improv, like improv's pretty simple. Like the rules are pretty simple. What we're trying to do is pretty simple. So I think it's like once you kind of get good at it and you can wield it, it's like seeing the Matrix.
Yeah.
So what really excites me is not when someone...
seeing the movie The Matrix?
No, actually, like when Keanu Reeves can see the numbers and see how the Matrix is made up.
Okay.
It's kind of like that is what I mean.
Because my mind was pretty blown when I saw The Matrix.
I should clarify that. But it's like seeing the Matrix. So when someone flies, it's amazing because you see how it all works and they've taken those rules and actually flown. Like that's the stuff that really makes me excited.
Mm-hmm.
Where when it's just, yes, you successfully yes anded, okay, well that's good, but that's just, you just went to work in the Matrix. Like that's not that exciting. But,
right.
But when, and that's why I said when it's bad, it can be anything because it just, this is weird mutations of things.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and also you're paraphrasing Tolstoy, right?
Yes, exactly. You'll see a couple times a day I paraphrase.
It's true.
Yeah, John knows.
Yeah, he makes me keep a list of all the times he paraphrases Tolstoy.
At the end of the day, if he's missed any of it.
But do you think that people, when people do improv poorly or badly, do you think they're generally kind of making the same mistakes? You know, like, sure, there's a bunch of different ways that you can make those mistakes, but I feel like it's, you know, if you do a bad scene, generally, I feel like you're either not connecting with your scene partner, you're not building a base reality, or you're not yes-anding something, and then shit kind of flies off the handle from there.
Yeah, I think not building a base reality is the biggest. To me, it's not building a base reality and not listening specifically enough in the moment. Because that's where I usually see scenes go awry, is that you've created this as two people in a waiting room, you know, waiting to see a doctor. And then someone will do something that doesn't really make sense for the way people act in that situation. And that's the kind of listening that you have to learn, is to recognize that. It's listening for behavior. It's awareness.
I think people get caught up in the words a lot of times.
Yeah,
it's like,
because we say listening.
Yeah.
And it's probably the wrong word. It's more awareness. It's more... it's like animals who are just, you know, mm-hmm. always aware of everything
monitoring
around them. It's like monitoring.
It's developing that sense of something weird is happening based on what we've established.
And I think it's also like, I'm just a person who, I don't like not knowing what's going on. I'm just like in every part of my life. Like if I walk into a room, I want to kind of understand what's happening. So at the top of an improv scene, I'm just naturally of like, I want to understand what's going on. I hate the weird of like, I don't know who that person is. And we're all just kind of moving around the stage.
Yeah.
Like, that stuff makes me kind of crazy. So I naturally am like, let's get the base reality established at the top of the scene.
Yeah.
Sometimes to a detriment, I think. Sometimes I move too fast, but it's if you don't have it, then I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, it's better than that rush to the funny that a lot of people kind of get caught up in, of like, well, this has to be hilarious.
Well, they rush to the funny, and then the scene is just them discussing an idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone will initiate with like, oh man, you know, what if Hitler was a midget? And then everyone will...
We cut to Hitler's a midget?
I wish, but we won't do that because it's a herald, so they don't think they can. So they'll just sit and all say funny things about things Hitler might say if he was a midget and the way people would talk to him. And then at the end, you watch kind of two writers brainstorm ideas for what you might do with a character rather than watching a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they never had a base reality. They just had, were two guys who talked about Hitler being a midget.
Yeah.
But I feel like sometimes you watch those improv scenes that come across a little bit like Abbott and Costello, who's on first, Mm-hmm. Which, as a comedy routine, is funny, but as an improv scene, you would be like, what? That's not fun. Like, all you need to do is explain the person's name, and that scene ends.
Yeah.
Like, well, that's, like, the biggest difference when you think about improv and sketch is that the Monty Python Dead Parrot sketch would never work as an improv scene. Because the only reason that scene works is because we can see the parrot.
We know that it's not.
We know it's actually dead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just an argument about reality.
Yeah. Otherwise, if you did it as an improv scene, we don't know if the parrot's dead or alive because we can't see it. So right. It would literally just be arguing about the reality of the scene.
Unless an awesome improviser in the back line steps forward and says, "We see that this parrot is dead."
Right.
Right.
Boom, or, I fixed
which
your
then
scene.
Seems like not that fun.
Yeah.
But
just take all the.
I also personally hate the "we see" move. I wish it did not exist.
Why do you hate it?
It feels artless to me.
Is that why you didn't give my spank a run?
Because it was all we see moves?
I just watched the stepfathers do it all the time.
So what's artless about it?
It's so meta, and it's meta, and it's a complete breakdown of reality. So it's a total meta move that I feel like is just blunt and horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel like I feel like often it's used unnecessarily and used to get a laugh, first of all. Secondly, I think there's so many scenes I see where like someone will come, we see this guy's in a top hat, and it's like, we already kind of knew he was rich. Your top hat didn't really help anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, I think there's probably a way you could do the same move as a character entering the scene and keeping the reality rather than going meta. It's totally personal. I'm not saying you should never do it. I think there's usually a way within the scene as a character entering or something else that if that move really needs to happen, which I think often it does not need to happen, if it really needs to happen, there's probably a more artful way to make the move.
Yeah.
Or as Delaney would say, a hip way.
Right.
But then contextually, like in a format of the movie, it's allowable.
Well, the movie is a meta form itself, so I think that's different.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I would say that it was a little bit like Swinging Doors, where it's like, overused in the wrong ways.
Oh,
occasionally,
yeah.
There's a time.
That's what I wanted to say. I think when we got cut off is that it's a new art form, pretty new, right?
Right.
It's only been around since the 50s or so. There were no tags before the family started doing it because they just wanted to be able to go faster. And really, a tag is just let's do a bunch of beats of this really quickly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. But there then was before then there was no tag. Then they had revolving doors, and now I think the tag has just replaced revolving doors, or swinging doors. I mean, in a more artful way.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we know if you tag and start exploring an idea, that you must tag back because we don't want to just get stuck in a discussion scene. So it's much more artful to be able to communicate in that way of like, oh, the kind of tag I make. And what I do after the tag dictates what's happening next instead of I have to grab you and turn your shoulders around to talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's actually cool. I think we developed a more artful way to do it. The same way we don't say we see very much anymore. That's also done with tags. You just tag out and move to the next scene, and we assume that. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. And that's also more artful. So I think the art form is kind of getting more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Although there's still, I guess that would be more of a cut to, right? Where it's like
cut to, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think we're also in a sort of a rough period. I feel like I'm hoping we'll develop something to replace the wave everyone off and then
yes.
Kick somebody.
That's kind of a new thing that's developed recently,
well,
right?
Well, I think it's that's instead of the, it says anything we cut to, yeah. That's like trying to do that. And I think people just have to learn. I mean, a lot of it's just communication and, obviously, when they were developing these ways, these new things to do with scenes, you need these shortcuts. And now that people know what they are,
mm-hmm.
We kind of can eliminate the shortcuts or make them even shorter. But I think you can just start the next scene and everyone just has to assume what's happening.
And I think to tie it back to what we were talking about earlier, if you're working with one group all the time instead of a bunch of groups,
yeah.
That stuff will come naturally. You don't need to say what you're doing. Like, you initiate that scene. Everyone knows, like, oh, this is Midget Hitler. we didn't have to, like, cut to him. We just knew that was what was going to happen.
That's the thing. I mean, I don't know. Since I've started... If you're going to do improv, then it seems like you should know why you want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was always like, I love the spontaneity of it. I love the freedom of we're making this up. So if it doesn't work, it sucks. And obviously, I beat myself up over shows for years and years. But
right.
But it's also gone. And you get to move on and do better the next time and learn from it. Go ahead.
It's like Tolstoy said, ever tried, ever failed, try again, fail better.
Yeah. I hope the first part of that bit did not get cut off. Otherwise, that'll make no sense.
Yeah, but I think if to me, the other reason to do improv is that, yeah, it's you and a bunch of people creating something on stage, then you can create something amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I always was, that's why I've always been drawn to it, is because there's moments where they're fleeting, but when you actually create something amazing, it feels, there's no better feeling than that. And if you're just one person in a bunch of different groups, I'm guessing you're not getting that feeling very often, because it's so rare that when everything comes together and everyone's on the same page and making it happen in the right moments, it's like, it's not going to happen if you're just kind of a bunch of people wandering around and screwing around all the time.
You're probably chasing those laughs and that instant gratification rather than chasing
And what else can you chase? That's all you have, really. It's like, let's get a bunch of funny people together. Everyone will do their funny thing.
If you are going from one group to another to another to another, like for yourself, you're just like, I just want to get laughs, rather than like, let's together build this interesting thing where we can collaborate and communicate.
That's something, another thing we were talking about being in ruts and stuff. The last couple of months, I'm coming out of it a little now, but I was in a rut where I could feel myself fucking going for laughs. And I was just beating myself up about it, couldn't make myself break out of it. And it is like, never has anything good happened in an improv show going for laughs.
How did you make yourself break out of that? Is that just trying to play different characters?
I get back into making moves that I know are not funny, but are setting up people. Mm-hmm. Or just like, the scene could use this, I can make that move. I can play your game by setting you up to play your game instead of me playing it.
Mm-hmm.
I just try to focus on that stuff.
It's good stuff.
That seems like a good place to end.
Yeah, I think so. How many out-of-state message boards do you think will...
how many more people can I piss off?
we'll be talking about you because of this podcast. okay, well, thank you very much, Anthony King. You can see Anthony and Ruben Williams. Let's Have a Ball, right?
I also sit in with the Stepfathers.
Oh, no.
Pretty regularly. never again.
That's right. They will never let you come on stage with them again. Okay. Thank you, Anthony. And thank you, Eric Tenoy. You were a great guest host.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And you can check out UCBtheater.com, UCBcomedy.com, et cetera, et cetera. See you next week.